Federal commanders came to depend on her, but kept her name out of official military documents. Her missions were clandestine operations, and as a Black and a woman, she became doubly invisible. Much of the information available about her war work was written up later when she applied for a pension, and again, much was lost. By July 1863, after spending so many frustrating months trying to make headway in South Carolina, Yankees trumpeted the Combahee River conquest. With the first public account of the raid on July 10th, Tubman's anonymity was preserved. Colonel Montgomery and his gallant band of 300 Black soldiers, under the guidance of a Black woman, dashed into the enemy's country, struck a bold and effective blow, destroying millions of dollars worth of commissary store, cotton, and lordly dwellings, and striking terror into the heart of rebeldom, brought off near 800 slaves and thousands of dollars worth of property, without losing a man or receiving a scratch. When the story of the Combahee raid blossomed onto the pages of Yankee papers on July 10, 1863, it heralded a new era. Moses was alive and well, and above ground in the war to end slavery. But any cover she might have maintained was completely blown when Sanborn wrote a biographical sketch of Tubman on July 17th. Using her full name, he highlighted her significant accomplishments and featured her key role in the Combahee military victory. Sanborn's front-page article in the Commonwealth, an anti-slavery journal in Boston, suggested that the nation had too long been deaf to her cries, while she was guiding fugitives to freedom. He believed the whole world should finally sing her praises. In this lengthy essay, Harriet Tubman was heralded by name and linked with her clandestine reputation as Moses. Sanborn's feature catapulted Tubman into the international spotlight, as once again, fans in Great Britain were awed by her exploits. In December 1863, the Reverend Moncure Conway, at an anniversary memorial to John Brown in London, quoted Harriet and exalted her for keeping Brown's legacy alive. After the Combahee River raid, all eyes turned once again to coastal Carolina, where a proud regiment of African-American soldiers from the Bay State had been sent to fight. The Massachusetts 54th Regiment was a project spearheaded by Tubman's ally and patron, Governor Andrew. He had thrown all his energies into showcasing this Black regiment from Massachusetts, which included soldiers recruited by Black leaders such as James Fortin, John Mercer Langston, and Frederick Douglass, whose two sons joined the regiment. A grandson of Sojourner Truth's also enlisted in this elite corps. From January through April 1863, nearly 1,000 Black men had been drilling outside Boston, preparing for combat duty under the supervision of white officers. Governor Andrew had fought to enlist Black officers, but relented under pressure from Washington, and instead drafted the cream of the Bay State's abolitionist aristocracy for command. Robert Gould Shaw, scion of wealthy Boston Brahmins, was an extremely calculated but inspired choice to head the regiment. Born into a wealthy anti-slavery clan in Massachusetts, educated in Switzerland and Germany before matriculating at Harvard, young Shaw was related to the Cabots, Lodges, Parkmans, and Lowells. With his impeccable credentials and zealous ideals, the 24-year-old Shaw enlisted once the war broke out. He was wounded at Antietam and gained the rank of captain. This dashing and handsome young officer fit the governor's bill. At first, Shaw was reluctant to leave his own regiment, even to participate in such a noble experiment, but his mother's pride that he would be willing to take up the cross proved persuasive. Shaw was promoted to colonel when he agreed to train and lead the Massachusetts 54th. He drafted officers from other prominent Boston families, such as Garth Wilkinson James, known as Wilkie, a younger brother of William and Henry James. Shaw married his sweetheart the first week of May, but his honeymoon was abbreviated when the men of the 54th were ordered to South Carolina. On May 28th, Black men in blue and their officers proudly marched through the streets of Boston with their infilled rifles over their shoulders. The men of the 54th sang John Brown's Body as they passed the site where African-American revolutionary hero Crispus Attucks had fallen, the first to die at the Boston Massacre. A Boston paper reminded its readers of a very different scene nearly a decade before, when Anthony Burns was deported. Boston had stood by while this fugitive slave was shipped south. But now the city cheered as African-American soldiers shipped out to defeat the slave power. This regiment was accompanied by the high hopes of radical Republicans and the moral and financial support of Boston's abolitionist aristocracy. The year before, men and women from Boston's upper crust had volunteered to serve at Port Royal as teachers and educators. Some would even die there, as did Wendell Phillips' nephew, Samuel, felled by disease in the summer of 1862. But those who elected to join the military campaign knew risks were even higher, and in combat many more would be left behind. The 650 men of the 54th landed in Beaufort, South Carolina on June 3rd, just in time to savor the news of the Cumbahee Raid. Shaw met up with fellow Bostonian Thomas Wentworth Higginson, also commander of a black regiment. Higginson's troops were as Southern as Shaw's men were Yankee, showing the remarkable diversity of Union soldiers, even within black ranks. Shortly thereafter, Shaw was transferred to St. Simon's Island, off the coast of Georgia, posted to the command of Colonel James Montgomery. Shaw, the bookish and youthful commander, did not get along with the more rough and tumble Montgomery. Shaw was bitterly disappointed by his men's first military foray under Montgomery's orders. This raid on Darien, Georgia, on June 10th, resulted in the burning of the town. Montgomery explained to Shaw that Southerners must be made to feel that this was a real war, and that they were to be swept away by the hand of God, like the Jews of old. Shaw wanted to disassociate himself from blatant disregard for civilian safety, a policy of which he disapproved. Further, he was aghast of Montgomery's bland response to the reports of arson and looting committed by black soldiers. It was particularly painful to the men of the 54th when Northern journalists derided the soldiers' behavior at Darien. Even a pro-abolitionist journal, The Commonwealth, described the town as a plain of ashes, following the invasion of Yankee Negro vandals who poured turpentine and applied the torch with abandon. Soldiers attempted to burn down a Methodist church. Shaw was humiliated at Yankee press reports that called his men brigands. The men of the 54th hoped to redeem themselves with a planned assault on Fort Wagner. This crucial fort was located on the northern tip of Morris Island, a few miles south of Charleston. The Union command believed this bastion held the key to the harbor. If the Yankees could take control, they might cripple blockade running along the coast and pave the way for conquest of Charleston. The 54th was expected to play only a small role, assigned the task of holding the line at nearby James Island. Yet during a Confederate attack on July 16th, three of Shaw's companies performed bravely, protecting the retreat of a white regiment. While the men of the 10th Connecticut abandoned their position, Shaw's men fought with bayonets in hand-to-hand combat, suffering 43 of the 46 losses during the Confederate raid. Shaw commended, "They fought like heroes." A journalist concurred, "Dark-skinned heroes fought the good fight and covered with their own brave hearts the retreat of brothers, sons, and fathers of Connecticut." Shaw used this success to curry favor. General George Strong, a brigade leader, requested that the Massachusetts 54th join him in leading the assault on Fort Wagner. The invitation was considered a great honor. The Union command faced extraordinary obstacles in plotting their assault, as the fort was practically impregnable. Waves washed up to the eastern wall at high tide, and marshes and bogs covered the ground leading to the other three walls. Further, the rebels ringed the fort's walls with a moat as well as a rifle pit. With more than 17 artillery guns aimed outward, the fort seemed invincible, but it was a prize Yankees eagerly sought. The chief battle strategist, General Quincy Adams Gilmore, underestimated both the Confederates' artillery and the resolve of the 1,600 rebel soldiers within the battery. When invited to lead the Union charge, Shaw's men were weary from the previous day's fighting and marching without rest. Rain on the 17th postponed the battle by a day. Shaw asked his soldiers to prove themselves as men and promised to carry the regimental flag himself if the color bearer fell. Tubman reported that she served Shaw his breakfast before he went off to battle on July 18th, a meal that would prove his last. By noon, nearly 9,000 shells had been lobbed into Fort Wagner, from ironclads at sea and artillery on land. When the fort's Confederate flag was shot away, the Union soldiers thought it meant surrender. They ceased fire and began to cheer, prematurely, as a Confederate officer mounted the rampart to display their battle flag, and shelling resumed. At sunset, General Gilmore wanted to send in the infantry. Shaw's men were dispatched to the head of the Union column in formation with two lines of two men deep, and one wing of five companies in the front, and another battalion bringing up the rear. 18-year-old Wilkie James confided to a fellow officer, "We have the most magnificent chance to prove the valor of the colored race now." Shaw and his men moved out at 7:45 p.m. They had to wade through water and sand to begin to move onto a narrow strip of land where the marsh cut across the island toward the ocean. As they moved along this corridor toward the fort's moat, Confederate guns began their deadly attack. Howitzers and canisters mowed down the Union Army's charge. Physical logistics and the gross underestimation of Confederate strength contributed to the Union's heavy casualties. After hours of bloody battle, lasting well past midnight, the Union assault failed. Although Federal units, especially African American soldiers, had fought bravely and well, by the wee hours of July 19th, scores of Union soldiers lay injured on the beach. When the tide came in, many drowned before they could be rescued by litter bearers coming to collect the wounded. When July 19th dawned, an eyewitness reported the gruesome scene. Blood, mud, water, brains, and human hair all melted together, men lying in every possible attitude, their limbs bent into unnatural shapes by the fall of 20 or more feet, the fingers rigid and outstretched, as if they had clutched the earth to save themselves. Of the 5,000 Union men engaged at Fort Wagner, more than 1,500, including 111 officers, were killed, wounded, or captured. The Massachusetts 54th lost 272 soldiers out of 650, including Shaw, a casualty rate of over 40%. Wounded whites, including Wilkie James, were evacuated to Hilton Head and placed in the care of Nurse Clara Barton, while black soldiers were transported to Beaufort, where Harriet Tubman awaited survivors. Although Tubman was horrified by the carnage, she took pride in the glory black soldiers earned that day. The New York Tribune suggested that Fort Wagner should be such a name to the colored race as Bunker Hill has been for 90 years to the white Yankees. Private Lewis Douglas, Frederick Douglass's son, survived the battle and confided, "Not a man flinched, though it was a trying time. Men fell all around me. A shell would explode and clear a space of 20 feet. Our men would close up again, but it was no use. We had to retreat, which was a very hazardous undertaking. How I got out of that fight alive, I cannot tell." Clara Barton commented bitterly, "We have built one cemetery, Morris Island. While the bodies of all other Union officers killed were returned by the enemy, the lifeless Robert Gouldshaw, riddled by 7 bullets, was withheld. Confederate gravediggers chose to bury the colonel with his niggers, as a rebel commander ordered, to strip Shaw's body and piled 20 dead black soldiers on his white corpse was intended as a gesture of Southern dishonor. To undercut the insult, Shaw's family discouraged attempts to recover their son's body, and expressed their pride that he had died among and been buried with his men. The 54th color bearer did fall during the battle. A black sergeant from New Bedford, William Kearney, rescued the regiment's national banner. He planted the flag on the Confederate works, and then, once retreat was sounded, rescued the flag and carried it back to Union lines, sustaining several wounds in the process. For his valor that day, Kearney would be the first African-American soldier to earn the Medal of Honor. Tubman offered the most moving assessment of battle to the historian Albert Bushnell Hart. "And then we saw the lightning, and that was the guns. And then we heard the thunder, and that was the big guns. And then we heard the rain falling, and that was the drops of blood falling. And when we came to get in the crops, it was dead men that we reaped." Although the Union would continue to bombard the fort and scheme to capture both Morris Island and Charleston Harbor, it would take years to achieve this elusive goal. But the renown won that day by black soldiers at Fort Wagner would endure. The war continued to inflict staggering casualties with no apparent end in sight. The Confederate defeat at Gettysburg on July 4th was a particularly bloody outcome, occurring simultaneously with the surrender of Vicksburg to Ulysses S. Grant after a protracted siege. Though the Union wrenched these two major victories from the rebels, draft riots in New York signaled a souring mood on the war. Lee and his generals refused to back down. As the war became one of attrition, generals on both sides were as concerned with filling the ranks as they were with winning the battles. In the first year of the war, the Department of the South's sick list included more than 52,000 incidents, which meant that each Union soldier serving in the Southern theater of war had been ill, on average, several times a year. Union surgeons recommended measures to reduce the sick list and prevent epidemics. This included digging wells for fresh water whenever possible, providing fresh vegetables for meals, requiring men to move their tents at least once a week, demanding that they bathe once a week, adding soil daily to latrines, burying kitchen refuse in deep holes, and burning dead animals. All of these preventative actions demonstrated a relentless struggle against war's deadliest foe. Summer was the peak season for sickness, and Harriet's nursing duties became more constant. During the summer of 1863, she faced the challenge of nursing African Americans wounded at Wagner back to health, as well as the even larger number of black soldiers who succumbed to South Carolina's debilitating and often deadly climate. More than the summer season concerned Tubman. She confided to Sanborn in July that she was also worried about her parents. "I have now been absent 2 years almost, and have just got letters from my friends in Auburn urging me to come home. My father and mother are old and in feeble health and need my care and attention." But Tubman explained she could not leave just yet because of the important work she was doing. She trusted the good people of Auburn would look after her family for her, perhaps hinting to the New England Freedmen's Aid Society that they would need to do more for the family she had left behind. During the fall of 1863, Harriet's own health went into decline, and by the following spring, she knew she could not endure a third Carolina summer. Tubman wanted to make a trip home in May 1864 to recover her health. She requested leave. Her commanding officers, both Surgeon Henry Durant, who supervised her work in the hospital wards, and General Saxton, who had sent her into the field, commended Tubman's service. They signed a certificate that enabled her to obtain military transport from South Carolina to New York and authorized her return after her furlough. Tubman made the long journey back to upstate New York in the summer of 1864, finding her parents well, considering their advanced age, and living peacefully at her home on South Street in Auburn. During her own convalescence, Tubman became fast friends with Sarah Hopkins Bradford, a staunch abolitionist from Geneva, New York. Bradford's brother, the Reverend Samuel Miles Hopkins, had befriended Tubman while he was a professor at the Auburn Theological Seminary. Sarah Bradford had regularly copied down letters for Ben and Harriet Ross, both illiterates, to send off to Harriet while she was away at war. They were addressed via her commanding officers and reached her down south. When Tubman returned home to Auburn in June 1864, Bradford showered her with care. Bradford was not alone among those in Auburn to herald Tubman. The community pitched in to praise their adopted daughter. Elsewhere, too, the Yankee press turned her into a freedom fighter, a Union heroine, and a celebrity, known now by her own name. When she felt well enough to travel from upstate New York, Harriet made a pilgrimage to see New England friends who had supported the launch of her military mission. On August 12, 1864, the Commonwealth announced, "This heroic woman, whose career we described last summer, when she was engaged in the military service in the Department of the South, has lately arrived in Boston." The article, under the heading Harriet Tubman, further informed readers that she had been inadequately recompensed by the military authorities and was using her own limited resources for the good of others. As a result, donations would be welcome. An address was provided for those who could contribute clothing and money, which would be distributed for the good of the colored race. As in previous visits to Boston, Harriet was given first-class treatment. It was during this period that she was introduced to another abolitionist stalwart, a black woman who was becoming, in her own way, equally legendary, Sojourner Truth. Truth had been born a slave, Isabella Bomfrey, in Ulster County, New York. Her birth year is unknown, but estimated as 1797. During her youngest years, Truth, like Harriet, was farmed out to local families by her owner, families who subjected her to rough treatment. English-speaking masters abused her, as her native tongue was Dutch. She was sold in 1810 to an owner named Dumont. Over the course of the next 16 years, she grew into a towering woman, 6 feet tall, married, and gave birth to 5 children. Like Harriet, Truth performed heavy-duty labors for her masters, hoeing corn, scutching flax, and other challenging physical chores. When Dumont reneged on his promise to free her, Truth took matters into her own hands and emancipated herself in 1826. In 1828, she moved to New York City and ended up living with a religious cult. By 1843, Isabella decided to strike out on her own and took the name Sojourner Truth. She began to preach as she traveled throughout the North. As was the case with Harriet Tubman, this phase of taking on a new name was a milestone. And like Tubman, Truth remained illiterate, but she confided, "I cannot read a book, but I can read the people." Although their lives took very different paths, these two women had much in common. During Truth's intense involvement with antebellum reform, she lived in a variety of communes, preached spiritual perfectionism, and became most closely associated with both feminism and anti-slavery during the late 1840s. Her Narrative of Sojourner Truth was published in 1850 with a fiery introductory essay by William Lloyd Garrison. Truth's narrative ended with her confrontation with a slaveholder, her former owner, who finally acknowledged slavery's evils. In many ways, Sojourner's conclusion represented the truth and reconciliation ideals of Tubman's youth. During most of the 1850s, Truth was on the road, mainly on the speaker's platform. In 1857, the same year that Tubman settled in Auburn, New York, Truth made Battle Creek, Michigan her permanent home. In 1863, Harriet Beecher Stowe penned an embellished biographical sketch of Truth, a piece for the Atlantic Monthly, which catapulted Truth from relative obscurity. Previously, she was known only within abolitionist circles, but this essay turned her into a figure of national reputation. Unfortunately, Stowe's essay was full of factual errors, including the misstatement that Truth was dead. But Truth seized on this notoriety and began a renewed round of public appearances. When she spoke, she would always offer copies of her autobiography or portraits for sale. It was during this bubble of publicity that Truth crossed paths with Tubman in the fall of 1864. Truth had left her home in Michigan accompanied by her grandson, bound for her first visit to Washington. Along the way, she offered speeches to promote Lincoln's reelection. She hoped to gain an audience with the president when she arrived in the District of Columbia. Truth doubtless knew of Tubman's work among the soldiers in the Carolinas and her exploits before and during the war. Equally, Tubman would have been curious about Truth, the compelling speaker whose lectures always opened with her singing spirituals. The article on Tubman in the Commonwealth in July 1863 suggested that her religious experiences are as startling as those of Sojourner Truth. Thus, it was not uncommon for these two women to be linked in the public imagination. Little is known about their first encounter, except that it allegedly took place in Boston. At the time, the women had conflicting views on Lincoln, for whom Truth was stumping. The topic of the president and his policy toward blacks surfaced during their discussions. Harriet had witnessed the second-class status of African-American soldiers fighting in the Union Army and blamed the commander-in-chief for this failing. When black men in blue were first recruited, they were offered a lower pay scale than white soldiers and asked to buy their own uniforms out of pocket, while white soldiers were given a clothing allowance on top of their higher wages. This was an enormous sacrifice, especially for many of the soldiers' families who needed money to survive once husbands and fathers left for the army. When black soldiers protested by refusing to draw any pay, they continued to perform their military duties. They demonstrated their loyalty, but rejected discriminatory wages on principle. thereby humbling the U.S. government into pay equity. Tubman fumed that these brave soldiers had to fight the enemy on two fronts. Tubman became embittered over the fact that white soldiers injured at Fort Wagner were sent to Hilton Head, while black soldiers were transported to Beaufort. The separate evacuation plans for handling the wounded, not to mention burying the dead in segregated graves, added insult to injury. She could not reconcile these injustices. She blamed Lincoln, even as Truth sang his praises. Tubman told Truth that she had no interest in meeting Lincoln, something she came to regret in later years. Their disagreements may have prevented them from cementing a deeper bond with each other, as sisters committed to a common cause. During her stay in Boston, close friends may have been even more solicitous of Tubman. She was only 39, but appeared much older because of her deteriorating physical condition. One of her confidants later reported that the fracture of her skull at the hands of a Maryland overseer when she was younger continued to undermine her health. During her time in Auburn in the summer of 1864, she suffered frequent spells. No description of these spells and seizures has turned up in any medical records, so speculation about Tubman's condition is based on sketchy eyewitness reports. One observer reported that she would, to her deep mortification, drop into a heavy sleep even when conversing, from which she will, after a time, arouse and resume the thread of her narrative where she left off. Everyone who commented on Tubman's disability suggested that her symptoms mimic what we today would call narcolepsy, a disabling neurological disorder. A narcoleptic will frequently drop off to sleep at inappropriate times, even mid-sentence, then slip back into wakefulness with no memory of this blackout period. Narcolepsy was first identified in 1877, and doctors studying the illness believed both that the disorder was genetic and that these episodes were triggered by emotions. But over time, it became clear that many sufferers experienced effects unrelated to psychological issues, and that symptoms might occur if a person suffered specific brain irregularities, mainly lesions in the posterior hypothalamus. The hypothalamus is the region of the brain that regulates wakefulness. Since narcolepsy usually begins its onset between the ages of 15 and 30, it is not even possible to tell if this condition was related to Tubman's adolescent head injury or was merely attributed to it. Without any contemporary data, and perhaps even with it, there is no way of knowing her exact medical condition. Tubman's disorder might well have been an inherited condition called cataplexy, sudden brief episodes of muscle weakness or paralysis. This condition is brought on by sudden strong emotions, anger, fear, and anxiety. It seems that if this were the case, Tubman would have been severely plagued during her UGRR career, but there are few comments about her disability from fugitives. Also, Harriet did not seem to suffer two of the most common effects of the disease, sleep paralysis and daytime sleepiness. No one ever accused Tubman of excessive daytime sleepiness, a prevalent symptom, and Harriet never complained of sleep paralysis, an inability to move when first waking or while falling asleep. However, during her fits, Tubman would have wakefulness invaded by short bouts of unconsciousness. Also, narcoleptics can suffer from hypnagogic hallucinations, vivid images that emerge at the onset of sleep. Both of these characteristics were described in detail by Tubman herself or those commenting on her illness. She was especially forthcoming about the remarkable dreams that visited her. But it is impossible to say if there was some physiological or neurological root cause of her visions. Victims of this disorder are taken out of themselves by irresistible attacks of sleep, which last from 30 seconds to 30 minutes. During Tubman's lifetime, the disease was barely diagnosed, and effective treatments came much, much later. Doctors nonetheless treated this illness by surgical means, most commonly cerebral spinal fluid removal. Perhaps her illness led her to see a specialist while she was in Boston. In any case, during one of her later visits to Boston, Tubman underwent an operation to relieve her symptoms. Whatever the source of her increasing discomfort, Tubman constantly sought medical relief. The surgical procedure she underwent at Massachusetts General Hospital somehow reduced her discomfort, although it reportedly did not completely cure her spells. In the spring of 1865, she overstayed her military leave and was not able to return to South Carolina as she had planned. She arrived too late in New York to catch her designated ride back to occupied South Carolina. but Tubman was eager to return, especially after the 13th Amendment, officially abolishing slavery, was passed by Congress in February 1865 and sent to the states for ratification. This act may have been the beginning of Tubman's changing attitude toward Lincoln, as she would eventually hold him in high regard. In March 1865, she went to Washington, where she obtained permission for military transport, which read, "Pass Mrs. Harriet Tubman, colored, to Hilton Head in Charleston, South Carolina, with free transportation on a government transport, by order of the Secretary of War, March 20, 1865. On her journey to New York to find a ship to take her back to South Carolina, she stopped off in Philadelphia. Representatives of the Sanitary Commission, the agency responsible for the care and treatment of the Union wounded, urged Tubman to abandon her plans for Carolina and instead to return to Virginia. They begged her to return to the James River Hospitals near Fort Monroe, where authorities were in desperate need of her skills. It was this pleading that caused Tubman to relinquish her plan to return to the Department of the South. She did not realize what the bureaucratic consequences of this absence might mean. Rather, as always, Tubman responded to immediate needs, part of the reason that her status remained unofficial, ad hoc, and so difficult to document in later years. Since Tubman had left Fort Monroe in the fall of 1861, more than 10,000 contrabands had passed through the garrison seeking assistance. Several thousand remained in residence, and a nearby school in Hampton boasted more than 500 pupils. Hospitals were filled with military patients, although black and white soldiers were treated at separate facilities. In March 1865, Harriet returned to the trenches, serving in the hospital wards of Union-occupied Virginia. Tubman rejoiced over Lincoln's visit to Richmond on April 4th and was roused by the news of Confederate surrender 5 days later, after 4 years of war. Like most Northerners, she was stunned by grief when Lincoln was shot in Ford's Theater on April 14th and died the next day. With the official conclusion of wartime hostilities, Tubman and her fellow ex-slaves recognized another turning point, just as crucial as the emancipation, as they sought the brass ring of citizenship. Impassioned rhetoric began even before the war ended, as Frederick Douglass thundered, "If he, the black man, knows enough to take up arms in defense of this government and bare his breast to the storm of rebel artillery, he knows enough to vote." Henry Highland Garnet, speaking in front of the House of Representatives in 1865, suggested that blacks would end their crusade for justice when emancipation shall be followed by enfranchisement and all men holding allegiance to the government shall enjoy every right of American citizenship. Tubman had experienced a righteous sense of anticipation, especially with the amendment to abolish slavery in February 1865. However, Harriet knew the struggle was not over. She remained in Virginia, working doggedly on behalf of soldiers and freed people through April, May, and June of 1865 in worsening conditions. Supplies were so limited and circumstances so dire by July that she was compelled to go to Washington to solicit help from her allies in the District of Columbia. She went to see the powerful men with whom she could obtain an audience and made an appeal for improved conditions at the military hospital where she served. As a result, so great was the confidence of some officers of the government in her that Surgeon General Barnes directed that she should be appointed nurse or matron. This was a high honor, and one that had not been granted to a black woman thus far. She returned to Fort Monroe on July 22, 1865, but the bureaucracy, weighed down by the post-war chaos, was slowing everything to a halt. Tubman's Washington contacts failed her, as neither any official appointment nor the promised supplies materialized. By this time, the 40-year-old Tubman had given years to the Union effort, with no regular salary, no back pay, no recognition of her valuable contributions. Now that the war was over, the pull of home overwhelmed her. Harriet Tubman rationalized that the country's need had ceased. She could in good conscience return to her parents, entirely dependent on her. She made her way back to Auburn, where family and community eagerly awaited her. In this last trip north, Tubman was part of the thousands who came marching home in the summer of 1865. Like many towns, Auburn built a victory arch to commemorate the triumph over Confederate foes. but it was a bittersweet victory, as the country mourned more than 600,000 soldiers who died during the 4 long years of war. Walt Whitman, who had also served as a nurse in Union hospitals and would later become the war's unofficial poet laureate, observed, "The camp, the drill, the lines of sentries, the prisons, the hospitals, ah, the hospitals, all have passed away. All seem now like a dream, and in the peaceful, strong, exciting, fresh occasions of today and of the future, that strange, sad war is hurrying even now to be forgotten." Indeed, in the post-war rush to reunion, only one Confederate was hanged for any actions taken during the War of the Rebellion, Captain Henry Wirtz, the Swiss-born officer in charge of Union prisoners at Andersonville, Georgia. Only a handful of Confederate leaders spent any time inside a prison. Even the Confederate president, Jefferson Davis, was rapidly rehabilitated in post-Civil War America, so much so that a Confederate veteran could declare as early as 1865, "We Rebs, so-called, have been overwhelmed, crushed out, subdued, defeated, or by whatever other name you please to call it, except disgraced. In the face of the civilized world, the honor of the South stands untarnished, and her sons will live in the world's memory as a chivalrous, gallant, and brave people." It was Harriet Tubman's hope that the noble and brave among African Americans might not be forgotten as well. But after the American Civil War, chivalry and gallantry would be reinvented and racialized by advocates of the lost cause, the Confederates' cult of nostalgia. These vigilant campaigns would cost African Americans dearly, especially during the prolonged battle to claim rights guaranteed by new constitutional amendments and federal enforcement of the law. The rise of the Ku Klux Klan, vigilante violence, and other campaigns of terror swept the post-war landscape. During Reconstruction, Southern freed people and blacks in general became scapegoats, suffering a violent backlash in war's aftermath. Tubman wanted African Americans to be granted the freedom and dignity they deserved, as well as the legal status they had won. For those who could not care for themselves or claim what they had a right to, Tubman would become a friend and protector. She would dedicate her remaining years to this important mission. Tubman herself fell victim to the backlash, even as she was returning home a war hero. On the train heading north to Auburn from Virginia, she was roughed up while passing through New Jersey. The conductor decided that Harriet's papers must have been forged or illegally appropriated, finding it incredible that a black woman could carry a soldier's pass. She was asked to leave her seat. Tubman politely refused. When she failed to move, the conductor called in assistance. Her stubborn resistance took 4 men altogether to eject her from her seat. She was dumped unceremoniously into the baggage car for the rest of her trip, let out of her imprisonment only when she reached her destination. Tubman suffered additional physical injuries from this incident, injuries that plagued her for several months, suggesting the seriousness of her resistance and the implacable contempt of the railway functionaries. This was Harriet Tubman's homecoming. Like so many of her fellow black soldiers, she found no road rising to greet her as she made the long journey home. She and other ex-slaves could only imagine the harsh struggles ahead. The land of Egypt might be behind them, but they were not in the promised land. In the months and years to come, Harriet Tubman would enjoy only the most bittersweet of victor's spoils. Chapter 12. Final Battles. She is the greatest woman of the age. Thomas Wentworth Higginson. After the war, Tubman retired her guns and gave up life on the road. She traded in campfires for her own hearth and returned to the home for which she had so long struggled. She created a household that was not only home to members of her own extended family, but a refuge for the forgotten and abandoned. Over the years, Harriet Tubman's charitable endeavors became a symbol for reformers, and her accomplishments the proof that individual dreams can shape a collective reality. When questioned by a white woman after the Civil War about whether she believed females should have the vote, Tubman replied with characteristic bluntness, "I suffered enough to believe it." During the post-war decades, Tubman became a grand old lady on the suffrage circuit. After addressing an audience, she was often described as spellbinding. Preacher and reformer James Freeman Clark commented on her great dramatic power as an orator. A longtime Auburn friend wrote, "As a raconteur, Harriet herself has few equals." She attended women's suffrage meetings faithfully in upstate New York. In 1897, the New England Women's Suffrage Association gave a fete in Boston to honor Tubman. There she enjoyed all the praises heaped upon her and was interviewed by Wilbur Siebert for his History of the Underground Railroad. Suffragist Susan B. Anthony introduced her as a living legend at the 28th Annual Convention of the New York State Women's Suffrage Association held in 1904. The Rochester Democrat described the scene. The old woman was once a slave, and as she stood before the assemblage in her cheap black gown and coat and a big black straw bonnet without adornment, her hand held in Miss Anthony's, she impressed one with the venerable dignity of her appearance. At this impromptu occasion, Tubman made her famous remark, "I was conductor of the Underground Railroad for 8 years, and I can say what most conductors can't say. I never ran my train off the track, and I never lost a passenger." In 1896, at the founding meeting of the National Association of Colored Women in Washington, D.C., Tubman was warmly embraced by the crowd and heralded as the oldest member of the National Federation of Afro-American Women. By the turn of the century, none could rival Tubman's accomplishments or outdraw the esteem felt by an audience of black club women. In war's immediate aftermath, Tubman's commitment to her race remained steadfast. She continued solicitations for the freed people of the South and recognized the long, hard road toward Reconstruction. She collected funds for the freed people's schools and hospitals, but soon after settling in Auburn, Tubman began to focus her energies on those around her, extending a hand to the needy and poor within the Finger Lakes region. Her focus on aged and indigent Negroes was appreciated by the white citizens of Auburn, who were relieved that African Americans would have their own champion. Tubman channeled donations into projects to help the less fortunate people of color within the town, orphans, disabled veterans, the blind, and others requiring assistance. Like most of the North, upstate New York offered only segregated social services. There were few opportunities for African Americans, especially in communities with small black populations. Without Tubman's solicitations, too many would have fallen by the wayside. She took in the poor, she took in the needy, without questioning how she could provide for these strangers as well as her own family. During Reconstruction, Tubman launched another crusade, one that turned into a 30-year battle. She struggled to obtain compensation for her military service. Like her campaigns before the Civil War, this was not undertaken strictly for personal gain, but rather as part of something larger, symbolic of higher purpose. Tubman knew her own contributions to the Union cause had been considerable. Soldiers, whatever their color, and loyal citizens, regardless of sex, deserved just compensation for wartime sacrifice. The government, as a matter of principle, should honor its commitment and repay those who made verifiable sacrifices. Just because her services had not been properly documented during wartime did not mean Tubman should be disqualified from collecting the wages she deserved. She only wanted fair treatment. While in Union service, Tubman assisted the Army with housing and hygiene for the hundreds and eventually thousands of contrabands who fled behind Union lines. When she ventured into occupied Carolina, it was no longer Tubman's private war against slavery. She operated within the theater of war to save the Union, under the auspices of the Secretary of War. In July 1865, before leaving Washington, Tubman had applied to her good friend and patron, William Seward, for assistance. Favorably disposed, Seward referred the matter to General Hunter, but at that time, no pay whatever was obtained. Doubtless, Tubman was unwilling to press her legitimate claim during the chaotic immediate post-war era. She was especially loath to pester Seward, who was preoccupied with affairs of state in the wake of Lincoln's assassination, and was himself recovering from stab wounds inflicted during a thwarted assassination attempt on the night Lincoln was shot. Tubman postponed her official appeal, believing that her powerful patrons would eventually prevail. One of her white friends confided that, while Harriet has never been known to beg for herself, the cause of the needy will send her out with a basket on her arm to the kitchens of her friends without a show of hesitation. But 2 years after the war, she felt more the burdens of being the sole support of her aged parents, trying to make ends meet with occasional handouts and selling her own homegrown produce and pies. Not surprisingly, Tubman fell on hard times and was forced to beseech former abolitionist friends for loans. A $60 gift from Wendell Phillips late in 1867 allowed Tubman's South Street household to be stocked with food and fuel to last during the harsh winter ahead. In October 1867, she learned that John Tubman had been murdered in Cambridge, Maryland, leaving behind his widow Caroline and their four children. A white man, Robert Vincent, had shot him in cold blood. The murder was committed on a lonely stretch of road with only John Tubman's 13-year-old son as a witness. A Baltimore paper reported, "The murderer has not yet been arrested, and we question whether he ever will. No effort that we are aware of has been made to overtake and bring him to justice." However, by December 16th, Vincent was apprehended and put on trial. The defendant claimed self-defense, and his all-white jury returned a verdict of not guilty after 10 minutes of deliberation. This was a disheartening blow to Harriet, both the violent death of someone whom she had loved and the callous disregard for justice that followed his murder. The Baltimore American editorialized, "As no one but a colored boy saw him commit the deed, it was universally conceded that he would be acquitted, the moment it was ascertained that the jury was composed exclusively of Democrats. The Republicans have taught the Democrats much since 1860. They thrashed them into at least a seeming respect for the Union. They forced them to recognize Negro testimony in their courts, but haven't got them to the point of convicting a fellow Democrat for killing a Negro. But even that will follow when the Negro is armed with the ballot." Harriet had little leisure to mourn, as the pressing needs of her household weighed on her. By November 1867, Tubman decided she must take her financial case to the federal government again. She visited Garrett Smith at Peterborough in hopes he might help with her claim. She brought along a letter from William H. Seward to Major General Hunter, dated 1865, in which Mr. Seward says, "I have known her long, and a nobler, higher spirit or truer seldom dwells in human form." Local advocates began to advertise Tubman's plight to promote her case. A Mr. R. Fisk reported, "A few warm, appreciative friends in Auburn help her, Tubman, from time to time." But he complained, "More ought to remember her and do for her what so many years and a much larger and with a far more deserving spirit than our own she did for the oppressed and needy, the suffering and afflicted in slavery and war." By 1868, former abolitionists in upstate New York mobilized on Tubman's behalf. When her financial crisis was revealed to Republican friends, community leaders penned endorsements for her to attach to her claim. One wrote a letter to the editor of the Auburn Daily Advertiser, complaining, "She hasn't yet succeeded in procuring any assistance from the government for the acknowledged services, especially in securing the scouts in South Carolina, who were so very successful in piloting our army about Port Royal, Hilton Head, and Beaufort." Her champions tackled the problem on more than one front. They sponsored an authorized biography, selling her story to raise funds, a common tactic from anti-slavery days. Her friend Sarah Bradford was drafted to prepare the manuscript for publication. Besides interviewing her subject, she amassed stories about Harriet from prominent statesmen, soliciting testimonials on Harriet's behalf. Bradford wove Harriet's own tales together with statements from luminaries such as William Seward, Frederick Douglass, and Wendell Phillips. Garrett Smith and other wealthy donors underwrote all printing costs. A January issue of Boston's Commonwealth announced the book's publication in 1869. Mrs. Sarah H. Bradford of Geneva, New York, has made quite an interesting memoir of this devoted woman, which has been published in neat book form, and the proceeds of the sales of which go to her support, she being now very old. Tubman was actually 44 at the time, and quite infirm. The price is $1 only, and copies can be procured at the rooms of the Woman's Club and the Freedmen's Aid Society, or they will be forwarded post-paid upon receipt of price by addressing Box Number 782, Boston Post Office. Advertising paid off, and the volume eventually yielded Tubman a windfall of over $1,200. Simultaneously, an Auburn banker named Charles P. Wood prepared a narrative of Tubman's war service with an appendix of available documentation. Copies are still on file at the National Archives. The result of Wood's research was originally scheduled to be included in Bradford's book, but it instead became part of the official claim sent to the House of Representatives. Faithful supporters like Garrett Smith chimed in. During the late war, Mrs. Tubman was eminently faithful and useful to the cause of the country. She is poor and has poor parents. Such a servant of the country should be well paid by the country. I hope the government will look into her case. Congress was supplied with a detailed account of Tubman's military assignments. Wood attached only a few of her orders and passes, explaining that because she was unconscious of the great value of the official documents she had from the several officers at different times, Harriet has lost some of them. Although she possessed very little paperwork from the period, those Union officers contacted were willing to supplement the record with letters commending her wartime service. David Hunter, Rufus Saxton, James Montgomery, and Dr. Henry Durant all provided Wood with detailed testimonials. Wood lamented that during more than 3 years of service, she received only $200, and with characteristic indifference to self, Harriet used this amount to build a laundry facility at Beaufort, where she taught the freedwomen to take in wash to become self-supporting. This altruistic effort was dealt a cruel blow when, during her absence with the important expedition in Florida, this wash house was destroyed or appropriated by a regiment of troops fresh from the north to make shelter for themselves, but without any compensation whatever to Harriet. When she liberated several hundred slaves during the Combahee River raid, she brought soldiers into the ranks, a service the Union regularly rewarded. Bounties for enlisting soldiers could run as high as $300 per recruit for substitutes, depending upon the state. Tubman recalled that she took roughly 100 of the adult male refugees to Hilton Head, to the recruiting officer, and they enlisted in the Army. She commented that Colonel Whittle said I ought to be paid for every soldier as much as a recruiting officer, but laws. I never got nothing. Wood carefully added that Tubman is known throughout the state and New England as an honest, earnest, and most self-sacrificing woman, and that all statements are obtained from her lips and from original papers in her possession, of which he offered copies. He confidently concluded that Harriet is entitled to several thousands of dollars in pay. There can be no doubt. Wood conceded that she held no commission and had not in the regular way and at the proper times and places made press and applications of and for her just compensation. Nevertheless, his lengthy narrative insisted that she finally be given her due. Wood's document took years to work its way through the federal bureaucracy. Sometime late in 1866 or early in 1867, a young black soldier whom Tubman had known during her wartime service in the South reappeared in her life. Private Nelson Charles had been born a slave near Elizabeth City, North Carolina, but escaped his master, Fred Charles, and removed to upstate New York. In September 1863 at Oneida, he joined the ranks of the New York 8th Regiment, Company G. After training in Philadelphia, the 19-year-old Charles moved south with his unit in January 1864. He landed in South Carolina, where he met Harriet Tubman. He accompanied an expedition to Jacksonville, Florida, in February 1864, where black Union troops occupied the town. On February 20th, Charles fought at the Battle of Alusty. His regiment retreated to Jacksonville, where he remained until April. Harriet departed to Auburn for a furlough in June 1864.